suffer with these unscripted talks. They can go a little bit wobbly sometimes. But if you go away with a few ideas which are useful and helpful, all the better. I'd like to talk some more about the subject of composure. As I was suggesting earlier, composure is this attitude of self-possession. The Buddha, when he described meditation to his monks, would talk about a monk going to the foot of a tree, closing their eyes, and being mindful and self-possessed. And that's what I mean by composure. It's that sense of collectedness, collecting oneself, readying oneself, being prepared, knowing what's going on, understanding what needs to be done. So it's got a quality of balance about it, of certain equanimity. So it's a form of self-control. Or if you like, it's the absence of a wildness of heart, an absence of instability or excitability. So it's a lack of passionate involvement. Put it in the negative for you. Composure is something that we see. Composure and the lack of composure is something that we see in the world all the time. I was very struck watching the Wimbledon Tennis Championships, watching these players, these elite athletes, playing this sport with such fine margins of error and so much pressure placed on them, and how repeatedly the ball would hit the line again and again and again while they're running around like maniacs. And the reason they can do it is because they've got their composure to such a fine degree, as well as their physical performance. And it's interesting to note that sometimes their composure would lapse. Something would happen. They would lose an important point. Or somebody would call out from the crowd. And for a little while their composure would go, and then they wouldn't be hitting the lines, because it's such a delicate balance for them. And I found that really fascinating, what it was, the changing conditions that was causing them to lose that absolute tip-top performance. The actual winner of the event, it transpired, actually practices a form of mindfulness, where he has learned to accept whatever emotions he goes through, learn to accept whatever kinds of reactions he has to events, and learns just to be with them in the knowledge that they will indeed pass. And that seems to give him a very slight little advantage. No wonder he won, because in the big points, in the moment, that absolute vital moment, he accepted conditions as they were. He didn't fight that sense of... I mean, if it had been me, I don't know about you, but if it had been me, and it's like a major point, I'm just about to win like millions of pounds, and I know that 3 billion people are watching me or wherever it is, that would quite have quite an impact on my serve. But he had... You've got to take your hands off that. You've got to take your hat off to the guy. That's fantastic. There are other kinds of composure and loss of composure. One thought that struck me just in the break there, or preparing this talk, was a sort of global loss of composure with regard to black gold, oil. How we discovered this substance, and we discovered we could use it for all these amazing things, and therefore it became very valuable. And how we had projected how long we thought the oil would last, and we've kind of just sort of just gone for it. Greed took over, and we've just used it all up, and it's caused absolute mayhem with the ecosystem, and we're now paying for the results of that. And that was a very definite loss of composure on a global scale. Another loss of composure recently that I noticed was, which was very interesting actually, because I don't know if you heard in the news that an American dentist had gone on a big game hunt in Zimbabwe and had shot a very much loved lion, Cecil. I have a name. And, okay, we all have our various views on that. If we keep the precepts, the first precept is not to kill and harm living creatures, but that's something we take on board ourselves, isn't it? We choose not to kill or harm living creatures. But the outcry to this dentist that actually performed that was frankly astonishing. I mean, how that guy must be feeling. Because there was this sort of global condemnation of him, and some of it was really, really quite cruel and wanted revenge and so forth. And there was a loss of composure as a reaction to what people actually saw, that something had happened which so went against their own view structures. On a lighter note, another loss of composure, which I thought was so sweet. I don't know if you remember, perhaps it was a year ago now, they had sent a probe into space to land on a comet. It's the Rosetta probe. And after years and years of hard work, they got this little thing, which was probably no bigger than a bathtub or something, hurtling through space at zillions of miles an hour. They actually got it to land on the comet, which is an absolutely astounding result. And they showed the reaction of the scientists. And there was this one particular scientist. She just completely lost it. She was so happy. She was so joyful. She was crying. She was hugging everyone. She was just talking gibberish. It was lovely to see. It was just like this complete sort of... And you can tell it was the pressure just being released. And it was just... It was astonishing. It was lovely to see. Bless her heart. The thing about composure is that in order to live happily and successfully, you really do need composure. A lack of composure is always suggestive of a great deal of self-concern. It's suggestive of the roots of greed, hatred and cruelty in various amounts. And it's always in relating to the world and the conditions of the world. And the Buddha talked about there being 8 worldly conditions that it is inevitable that all of us will encounter from time to time. It's impossible not to live your life. In fact, you can almost say that life is basically learning to navigate these 8 worldly conditions. What are they? What are the 8? There's 4 sets: pleasure and pain. So it's inevitable, given we're human, we've got bodies and minds, that we will experience pleasure and pain. Gain and loss. We gain where we don't want to gain. We lose where we don't want to lose. It's inevitable. There's nothing you can do about it. Don't laugh. That's not compassionate. No, it is. I'm only joking. Oh, yes, fame and obscurity. Oh, how the world wants... Everyone wants to be famous now, don't they? Reality TV shows, talent shows, and the rest of it. And then you become really famous, and then people start nosing into your business, and all you want is obscurity. And finally, praise and blame. This is inevitable that you will be praised in life. It is inevitable that you will be blamed. The Buddha's Noble Eightfold Path is teaching us, showing it is a training in composure. It's learning how to be composed in the face of these ever-changing conditions. And the tennis player and the scientists and people in general are all learning in their own ways how to deal with these ever-changing worldly conditions. You remember Kipling's poem If? You know, the one about if you can meet with triumph and disaster and treat those two impostors just the same, then you'll be a man, my son. Perhaps we can sort of say, if you can meet with the 8 worldly conditions, and treats those impostors just the same, then you'll be a true meditator. So in a sense, the Buddha's Noble Eightfold Path is wanting to ultimately help us to come to see that all these eight worldly conditions are indeed impostors. How do we do it? We follow the Noble Eightfold Path and its three trainings in ethics, meditation and wisdom. And we know that I'm going to have to talk about these in a linear fashion. So I'm going to talk about views and intentions, then I'm going to talk about being harmless, then I'm going to talk about knowing oneself, then I'm going to talk about realizing emptiness. Now, all this happens simultaneously in reality, but I can only talk about them one at a time. So it's recognizing throughout this that in order to accomplish one, you have to develop the others too. So all these various factors are all developed simultaneously. So I'd like to start with views and aspirations. And remember, this is all around the idea of developing composure with regard to these eight worldly conditions. Views are so important in terms of whether we suffer or not, or how we deal with worldly conditions. If it is the case that somebody sees nothing blameworthy in killing, shooting animals. There was another picture, actually there was another picture of a woman gleefully wrapped around a dead giraffe that she'd just shot. And it does, you do wonder, but we're not judgmental. That's the point, because that's the condition that you're faced with, isn't it? That's the condition that you're now being faced with. If you've got an attachment to the view that people should not kill animals, then you're going to experience painful feelings, aren't you? And then you're going to have to deal with those painful feelings, because the reality is that people do. That's just the reality. That's what the human realm's like. It happens. So composure in terms of views and aspirations and intentions comes from having the right views. So if you have a view of, say, rebirth, if you have a view that one's actions has results, if one has the view that there are indeed these worldly conditions and they can't be avoided, then that helps to generate composure. The composure to be able to look at a situation like that and say, yes indeed, isn't life unsatisfactory? First Noble Truth. And to react now with resistance, to react with craving, I lose my composure. I lose my sense of balance. Because the human realm is where beings come to learn awkward lessons, difficult lessons. And they experience the results of their actions. Even if that result is global condemnation. Very tricky, very difficult. But along with views comes aspirations. And the Buddha talked about three basic aspirations. The aspiration towards renunciation, loving kindness and compassion, being the opposite of the negative roots of greed, hatred and cruelty. So if you're composed, even in a situation where you're looking at social media and you're looking at something like that that's happened and somebody is being very cruel about somebody else, it's recognising that you don't have to lose your composure in that, because you've got a wider view structure, you've got a longer view, do you see what I mean? You see things more deeply because you've got these right views. So you are less likely to fall into condemnation or justification. You are far more able then to acknowledge that indeed life is like this. And that's not indifference. We're not talking about indifference. We're not talking about being unfeeling. We're talking about maintaining one's composure, which is a very different thing. So I can't go into these in too much depth because time doesn't allow. But the second aspect of this that I wanted to talk about was harmlessness. That if your aspirations are towards harmlessness, that is renunciation, loving kindness, and compassion, then it does make a great deal of sense to practice precepts, keeping the precepts, and developing parami, so developing very positive qualities such as generosity and service and the like. What I wanted to bring out about this aspect of the path is that practicing harmlessness makes it easier to maintain one's composure in life. Because through keeping precepts, through practicing the parami, you begin to tilt the balance of conditions in your favour. Do you know what I mean by that? Because they are karmically wholesome, which means they produce really pleasant results. It means that you actually tend towards experiencing, well, just that, pleasant results, as opposed to painful results. So the Buddha likened it to, you put a pinch of salt into a cup full of water and it becomes undrinkable. Do you know this analogy? You put the same pinch of salt in a freshwater lake and it doesn't make any difference. So by practicing harmlessness, the conditions, the eight worldly conditions that you actually personally experience are far more likely to be the ones that you would like. For instance, without being too personal, if I was a little bit more careful with what I ate, I'd practice a little bit more renunciation, perhaps I wouldn't be quite so embarrassed about my waistline. It makes sense, doesn't it? So I'd be embarrassed about that. I'm mentioning it now, I shouldn't even mention it. So I don't mean to go on about myself. But the point being that you, through your actions, you can actually create a world in which it is far easier to maintain your composure. The third of the aspects of the Noble Eightfold Path, I think, really it is so crucial, really. It's to know oneself through and through. To practice mindfulness. To understand yourself. To understand the mental qualities that occur. To understand the order that they occur, the processes that occur, to understand why you do things in the way that you do them. To have self-knowledge in that sense. Because you need that if you're going to live a harmless life. Because you need to understand where you're acting with greed, hatred and cruelty, and where you're acting with renunciation, loving-kindness and compassion. You can only know that if you practice mindfulness. And you can only know that if you practice mindfulness rightly. And this is a really major point that I don't think... I'm back on the same old bandwagon about mindfulness as this popular new pursuit that people go in for. Do people really know what mindfulness is? Sometimes I wonder, because there's this new craze for mindful colouring books. And this is not a criticism of colouring books. Lovely thing to do, it's a lovely pastime. And I'm not being facetious, honestly. It's just, don't call it mindfulness. Because although there is an aspect of mindfulness to it, it is actually exercising concentration. And people don't know the difference. And what people are doing, what they're saying is, like, while I'm doing my colouring in, I'm not thinking about those anxious thoughts. I'm free of those anxious thoughts for the time being. Now, that's not what we're involved with here. What we're involved with is actually experiencing the full range, possible range of human experience. We want to observe it all because we want wisdom, not just temporary freedom from unwanted states of mind. We want to understand. That's what transcendence is. It's an understanding. It's not a particular state. So I think people get confused about that. If you're going to overcome negative qualities, if you're going to overcome fetters that bind you to the wheel of samsara, you have to look at them. There's no other way of doing it. You have to look at them to know them and understand them. It's important that one knows oneself thoroughly, through and through. One knows all the mental states that occur. That's why labelling is such an important aspect of meditation. It's not just about getting tranquil and calm. It's about knowing, it's about understanding. So that requires great composure when you sit to meditate. And in a sense, what we're doing when we meditate is we are dealing with the world, these eight worldly conditions again. And what, because no one can walk into a meditation, their first meditation ever, and just be absolutely perfectly poised and composed, it is a training in composure. So you go into meditations at first believing that it's all about being calm and peaceful and tranquil. And then you experience pain and agitation and restlessness. And what's the new word? Antsy. That seems to be the new word. Antsy is the new word, meaning restless, feeling, you know, antsy, restless. So all the things that you don't want, you experience. And so you're back into this whole game of gain and loss. I want there to be tranquility and peace and calm. But there isn't. I'm faced with anxiety or pain or such things. Or alternatively, maybe it does go all lovely and calm and peaceful. And then elation arises. Oh, look, it's all lovely and peaceful. Well, it was until I started doing that. Now it's all gone again. This is why before I was talking about composure being, it's more than just sitting and watching. It's about composing the meditation, bringing in, being thoughtful. What is it that I'm doing here? Why is it that I'm doing it? What do I have to be aware of? Well, I know that I've got a tendency towards elation when things go calm, for instance. Okay, so I've got to be mindful of that. I'm not saying it will happen, I'm not saying it won't happen, because actually the meditation is just about being with what is present right now. Because if you're caught up in the worldly conditions, you're fighting with it, aren't you? You're saying it should be like this or it should be like that. But if you're just dealing with what's arising in the moment, then you have no expectations. You have no belief about what the meditation should be or shouldn't be, or what should be in the meditation or what shouldn't be there. You're just dealing exactly with what comes up. So it helps to compose yourself before you begin to meditation. And somebody said something very interesting to me recently, an idea that they'd taken into meditations, and they found it very helpful. So I thought I'd pass on the information. It was just like a little motto that they gave themselves, which was to go into the meditation and sit like the Buddha. Because I'm sure, I'm pretty much definitely sure, when the Buddha sat down to meditate, he didn't start going off into fantasies and daydreams or worrying about whether he was going to get tranquil or not. He was the Buddha. How would a Buddha meditate? I don't think I'll try and answer that one. But it's almost like a recollection of the Buddha, isn't it? To think, well, how? Well, they say, don't they, that if you want to become successful at something, one way of becoming successful is to imitate people who are successful, to imitate their ways of doing things. So why not? I don't think it's sacrilegious. I don't think it's disrespectful just to think about the Buddha and think about the Buddha sitting meditating. You will be faced with those eight worldly conditions when you sit to meditate. I was thinking about the one aspect of meditation as an example, where you get the contracted mind, where, you know, where everything seems to just, like, you get really tense in your body and the mind seems to contract, and it's very unwieldy and you can't really seem to do anything with it. Am I the only one who experiences that? Anyone else experience it? No? Just me? Oh my goodness. Why is it happening? Why does it happen? It happens because you stop being content with just what's happening right in front of you. And what you're attempting to do is somehow get past something you don't really want to accept. And so there is this constant... Oh, I can see. Yeah, I see. A few smiling faces again. Begin to recognise where I'm coming from. There's a tendency to just sort of like, you kind of half accept that there's something there, but you're not really looking at it directly. You're sort of saying, well, no, that's not supposed to be in the meditation. The meditation isn't supposed to have that there. And that's why it goes all cramped. And the way that you release yourself is through abandoning the expectation that you had, or abandoning any thought that the meditation should be anything other than it is right now. And that's how you release yourself from it. And it is a loss of composure that is causing that crampedness. So you have to regain your composure. And that's something to remember with meditation, is you are always allowed to start again. You are always allowed to say, well, hang on a minute, I can't keep this up for an hour, this is ridiculous, this is just not working, and have the intelligence to go back to basics. All right, okay. And reset up the composure again. Okay, what is that I'm supposed to be doing? And it's in those moments that you can actually begin to see what it is that you don't want to be there. And that's critical, because that's what you're trying to learn. That is exactly what you're trying to learn, the very thing that you're ignoring. Okay, moving on. The fourth aspect to the path that I wanted to talk about is realizing emptiness. Realizing that indeed these eight worldly conditions are complete imposters. That the whole world is constantly losing their composure with regard to pleasure, chasing pleasure and avoiding pain and gain and loss and the rest of it. Not recognizing for a moment that these things have no inherent reality to them, other than the most general or artificial, superficial sense. It's like these eight worldly conditions are just the sort of mere skin of life. They don't go any deeper at all. How do you discover this? Through Vipassana meditation. Through knowing yourself thoroughly and being willing to look at every aspect of your subjective experience and observe their true nature. I know it can come across as a bit like divine madness, like, what the hell is he talking about? But it is actually the case, if you look and you, again and again, with composure, and this is the problem with Vipassana, of course, it's going to test your composure, because it's digging into your most basic assumptions about how you think life is. But if you persist, and you're willing to go all the way with it, you see again and again that all these worldly conditions are so fleeting and are so conditioned and are so out of anybody's control, they just arise and pass away again and again and again, that to chase after those worldly conditions as a way of finding lasting happiness, that's the madness. That's crazy. The more you see it, the more, why am I even doing that? And you gain this tremendous composure. I stubbed my toe the other day. I hit the the sofa. So you know what happens when you stub your toe? It's like, oh, well, the whole world plays and does die. And that's what I experienced. But then it just completely just disappeared. It was just like, oh, oh, that's what happens when you stub your toe, isn't it? That's just what happens. That's just how you react. There's nothing wrong with it. No, it's not right or wrong. That's just what happened. But there was nothing after it. It just completely left, because that's the point. The wisdom grows so strong and so deep and so complete that you don't even, in the end, you don't even have to practice composure. It's like, no, I've got to be harmless. You go beyond that, because the knowledge just cuts, the wisdom cuts through completely. And you realise there's no point chasing that pain. There's no point wishing that pain away. He's already gone. I survived to tell the tale. Yes, so that's what watching transience and watching, learning, observing, coming to understand conditionality directly, that's what it will give you. It will bring you this. There are battles on the long way, don't get me wrong. The ego will fight back, and there will be tough times and difficult times, but you stick with it and it reaches a point really where you burn your bridges and you can't really go back, which is fine. But you keep going, you reach this point where you go beyond those worldly conditions and you go beyond the need for composure. It becomes just, it is just the way it is. Because you see things rightly, you see things as they really are. So, there you are. Composure. I'm sure I'll be talking to people when I see them talking about it again, because I find it such an interesting subject. So just to recap then, it's views. Views and intentions are important. Living a harmless life, keeping precepts and parami. Knowing oneself through and through thoroughly, and practicing vipassana to realise emptiness, to realise that all these worldly conditions are just illusory. Good, thank you very much.